and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for October 29th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, new data suggest 1 in 5 sun-like stars harbor an Earth-like planet, targeting the epigenetics of tumor cells to fight cancer, and how people detect errors and take credit for mistakes they didn't make. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about robotic hands that don't have any fingers, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Before scientists detected planets around other stars, the standard picture of planet formation was basically that every star that was like our sun would have planets that looked more or less like our solar system.
When the first extrasolar planets were discovered, all that was sort of turned on its head.
Andrew Howard is an astronomer at the University of California, Berkeley.
The first planets that were discovered were Jupiter-mass planets orbiting extremely close to their host stars. We found planets in highly eccentric orbits, in a sort of comet-like orbit. So there were a lot of initial surprises, and we're trying to incorporate those surprises into planet formation theory.
But now Howard and colleagues report in a paper in this week's Science, there's another surprise. The likelihood that there are lots of Earth-like planets and planet candidates orbiting very close to their parent stars, when the theory predicts there should be relatively few.
I don't think this requires a total rewriting of the theory, but it definitely needs some refinement around the edges to match our observations.
The observations Howard and his team made were of 166 sun-like stars within 80 light-years of Earth. Over a period of 5 years, the team measured the radial velocities for each star at least 20 times. That told the team about any wiggle of a star as it moved toward or away from Earth. And that's evidence that a planet is orbiting, tugging on its parent star. In total, 33 planets were detected around 22 stars that were in the team sample, with some of the planets detected by other teams of researchers. 16 of these planets are very close to their parent stars, including 5 low-mass planet candidates.
We think that low-mass planets like the Earth are relatively common. And that means that if they're common, they're nearby. And that means that future missions that are going to try to hunt for these Earth twins probably don't have to look that far. They can just examine a modest sample of nearby sun-like stars.
It's the first quantitative assessment of the frequency of Earths. Prior to this, it's just based on models or guessing.
Sarah Seeger is an astrophysicist at Massachusetts Institute of Technology and is not affiliated with the paper.
I grilled Andrew Howard after I read the paper, and I actually did have a number of questions, and he answered all of them. So I would say that they definitely had to make a number of different assumptions, and all these assumptions are approximations, but none of them are hugely significant to getting the final answer.
Overall, Howard's team estimates that 1 in 5 of these sun-like stars have an Earth-like planet.
I would say one of the concerns that everyone should be aware of is they didn't actually find planets with Earth mass. They're unable to find planets of that low mass right now. And so the biggest factor in the main result is extrapolating from more massive planets to less massive planets.
What we firmly detect is that,
again, study author Andrew Howard,
the largest planets like Jupiter's, the close-in planets like that orbit about 1 in 2 out of 100 stars like the Sun. And as you go down in mass to, say, Neptune-mass planets, Neptunes are about, well, they're 17 times the size of the Earth, those planets we find around 6 or 7 stars per 100. So they're much more common than Jupiter's. As we go down even further in mass to the so-called super-Earth-sized planets, these are planets that are about 3 to 10 times the size of the Earth. Those planets are more common still. We find them around about 12 per 100 stars. We're unable to directly detect the close-in Earth-like planets, but we can extrapolate based on this trend that we see among the more massive planets. And based on that extrapolation, we expect that something like 23 in 100 or 23% of sun-like stars have a planet that has a mass comparable to the Earth.
But again, these are planets that are close in to their parent star and so not likely to support life.
So they're inside the orbit of Mercury if you were to put them in our own solar system. That means that they're probably very hot, you know, much hotter than Earth, and therefore perhaps incompatible with life as we know it on the Earth.
But astrophysicist Sarah Seeger is excited about the results because planets close in to their parent stars suggest other planets around the same stars that are further out and in what's commonly called the Goldilocks zone. Not too hot, not too cold, but where an Earth-like planet could have liquid water and so possibly support life.
For almost every kind of planet that we have been able to measure, the more massive kinds, there appear to be many more of them out near the Goldilocks region or beyond than really close to the star. So I'm really excited about the result because we can guess that there are more Earths in the Goldilocks zone than there are really close to the star. So this is good news for us.
For now, though, study author Andrew Howard says astrophysical theorists will go back to the drawing board.
So I think the theory needs to be revised, and some of the theorists I've talked to are excited about this. This is sort of an opportunity for them to, their models have now been tested and compared with observations, and they have new work to do to try to figure out what's really going on.
And both Howard and Seeger, along with perhaps the whole astronomical community, are looking forward to getting even more observational data from NASA's Kepler mission, which should confirm Howard's team's result. Again, astrophysicist Sarah Seeger.
While we love to extrapolate and we love to speculate, really seeing is believing. And most scientists will not come out and agree on anything until we actually have the real data. So it will take more data. But right now, the Kepler Space Telescope is in space, in an Earth-trailing orbit, looking at one field of stars of 150,000 sun-like stars for 3.5 years. And Kepler's job is to tell us the frequency of Earth-sized planets in Earth-like orbits around sun-like stars. The Kepler Space Telescope is doing a very complementary approach to the current study that came out today. So we're really looking forward to the Kepler announcements that will be forthcoming next February when they release data. So this paper, the results today, are giving us the first glimpse. And Kepler should give us the answer that we're really looking for.
You can read Andrew Howard and colleagues' this paper, The Occurrence and Mass Distribution of Close-In Super-Earths, Neptunes, and Jupiters, in this week's Science. Also in this week's Science, Assessing Biodiversity Conservation. Over the past 4 decades, human activity has substantially affected natural habitats, with species extinction rates reported to be 100 to 1,000 times higher than they were before we came around. In response, in 1992, the Convention on Biological Diversity set a goal to significantly reduce the rate of biodiversity loss by 2010. 2 articles published by Science this week examine the outcome of this effort and what lies ahead for biodiversity in this century. In a paper titled "The Impact of Conservation on the Status of the World's Vertebrates," Mike Hoffman and colleagues conclude that current conservation efforts remain insufficient to offset the main drivers of biodiversity loss in agricultural expansion, logging, overexploitation, and invasive alien species. In a review article titled "Scenarios for Global Biodiversity in the 21st Century," Enrique Pereira and colleagues conclude that scenarios consistently indicate that biodiversity will continue to decline over the 21st century, but that there are significant opportunities to intervene through better policies. Find both papers online at scienceexpress.org.
This story is about a new way of treating cancer, a new approach to developing cancer drugs that tries to take advantage of what are called epigenetic changes in cancer cells.
Science's Jocelyn Kaiser reports in this week's issue on a research team that hopes to prove that a new approach to cancer therapy can halt solid tumors and satisfy skeptics who question how the drugs being tested actually work.
So instead of trying to target a mutation in the cell that causes it to grow out of control, this new approach develops drugs that try to change the cell's epigenetic abnormalities. That refers to changes in the cell that affect how DNA is expressed that don't involve changes in the DNA sequence. They involve changes in chemical groups that are attached to the DNA that affect whether the code can be used to make proteins or not, whether the gene is turned on or off, or they can be chemical changes to the packaging around DNA that affect whether the genes can be turned on or off.
So at this point, is there scientific consensus that epigenetic changes cause cancer?
There is definitely consensus that epigenetic changes occur in cancer. There have been decades now of studies that show that tumor cells not only have a lot of changes in the DNA, but they have abnormalities in these epigenetic marks, in the what are called methyl groups on genes and in the what's called chromatin packaging that the DNA comes in. So for many years, researchers thought that all the changes that mattered were the changes in the DNA of the tumors, but now there's a lot of evidence that these other changes can be part of cancer too. But what isn't completely clear is whether these epigenetic changes are a result of the cancer or if they're actually causing the tumor or the cells to grow out of control.
Do all cancers have these epigenetic changes?
I think pretty much all cancers do have epigenetic abnormalities. I think they're more prevalent in some cancer types than others, but researchers see them in all kinds of cancer. It's a matter of whether these genes, mutated or not, whether they are turned off or on. It's more like an on-off switch rather than a change in the gene itself.
What causes epigenetic changes?
Well, the early history of this field began when researchers were playing around with a compound that they knew could kill cells, and they found out that it seemed to be changing the expression of genes. They added it to mouse embryonic cells, and they turned into muscle cells. Yet it didn't change the DNA, so that made them realize that there was some other way of changing gene expression that didn't involve changing the sequence of DNA. And so you can make this happen with drugs that can take these chemical groups on and off the DNA. And there are also environmental factors that can cause epigenetic changes, although that's not something I get into in my story.
So this example, this drug, how did researchers use their knowledge of epigenetics to create this drug in order to treat cancer patients?
Well, they didn't actually create the drug. It was an old drug that had been used in clinical trials but was abandoned because it was too toxic. And so researchers kind of rediscovered this drug and realized that it could do interesting things in the lab that could turn genes on and off by affecting these groups, chemical groups attached to the genes. And some researchers who were treating patients with a kind of leukemia decided to try it and found out that at low doses, it wasn't too toxic. And in fact, it helped these patients. So they were treating a disease called myelodysplastic syndrome, which is a kind of pre-leukemia, a blood cancer.
So with the lower doses, somehow this drug was affecting the epigenetics of the DNA?
Yeah. So this is something that hasn't been worked out completely, but what researchers think is happening is at higher doses, it just kills the cells, but at lower doses, it does something to the DNA of the cells that makes, when the cell is dividing, its daughter DNA no longer has those chemical groups attached to it. So in effect, it's removing the methyl groups from genes. And that only seems to happen at low doses.
And so the drug is targeted towards the particular methyl groups that are causing this disease?
It's targeted towards the methyl groups. There's a sort of an excess of methyl groups on tumor suppressor genes, genes in tumors that can stop the cells from growing uncontrollably. So this drug removes those methyl groups from those tumor suppressor genes so they can be turned back on and the cell will stop growing out of control. That's the idea anyway.
It sounds like a great therapy. What are the downsides?
Yeah, so one downside is that the genes that have these methyl groups in a cell include not only cancer genes, but it could include a lot of other genes, including maybe some genes that cause cancer if you take the methyl groups off of them. So the drug is not specific to just the tumor suppressor genes. And it also is going to affect not only cancer cells in your body, but normal cells too. So it could have effects that go beyond stopping the cancer. It could have some side effects.
So is that what researchers are focusing on and trying to improve these epigenetic therapies, these drugs?
Some researchers are trying to find what they describe as more specific drugs because when these drugs are stopping this methylation, they're actually blocking an enzyme that would transfer the methyl groups to the new DNA as the cell's dividing. And there are several enzymes that do this. And so if you could develop a drug that targets just the enzymes, specific enzymes, you might not turn on as many genes as you are with the current drug. So now what these researchers who I wrote about are doing is they're trying the drugs I was describing that were used to treat this blood cancer already approved by the FDA for that cancer. They're trying them in solid tumors. That includes like lung cancer and breast cancer. So they have been tried in the past, again, at high doses and didn't seem to work in those tumors. But these researchers think that if they give them in low doses that they will work, and they have kind of early results suggesting that they can help lung cancer patients. They've treated something like 28, and a few of them had a really good response. Their tumors shrank, and others, it at least stopped their tumors from growing. So they're optimistic that they may turn out to work and help these patients.
So a new tool, along with nanomedicines and immunotherapy, we're not just stuck with chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery anymore in terms of treating cancer.
That's right. There's a lot of newer kinds of drugs, including this one, that it may turn out work best in combination. It may be that just one of these isn't going to stop the cancer, but combine it with another one. And no one thinks you can cure cancer anymore, but you might be able to manage it as a disease. That's what cancer researchers say.
Jocelyn Kaiser, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Scientist Jocelyn Kaiser reports in this week's issue on a research team that hopes to prove that a new approach to cancer therapy can halt solid tumors and satisfy skeptics who question how the drugs being tested actually work. In this week's Science, find a special series of reviews and perspectives and a video that look at what defines an epigenetic system and how epigenetic processes influence biology. Also in this week's Science, fiber optic strain sensors. The ability to measure tiny changes in strain, and therefore length, has helped biologists pull apart strands of DNA, geologists monitor deformation of the Earth's crust, and physicists in the search for theoretically predicted gravitational waves. So far, the most sensitive of these strain rulers are these gravitational wave interferometers, but they are extremely complex and cumbersome, measuring a few kilometers in length. Smaller, portable optical fiber sensors have been developed to monitor strain within aircraft or on the seafloor, but these fiber optic sensors are much less sensitive than their kilometer-long counterparts. Now, in a paper published online by Science, Gianluca Gagliardi and colleagues report that by using an optical frequency comb for stabilization, the sensitivity of these fiber optic strain sensors can be enhanced by several orders of magnitude, and so could lead to a new generation of fiber optic strain sensors that are both highly sensitive and versatile. Find the paper, Probing the Ultimate Limit of Fiber Optic Strain Sensing, online at scienceexpress.org. Sometimes even the most skilled musicians strike a wrong note. Even the most famous orators mispronounce a word. Even the best typists hit a wrong key. Errors are made by everyone, and the ability to detect them is essential to cognitive control, adapting to whatever situation, such as a mistake, and, say, correcting it. But as Gordon Logan and Matt Crump of Vanderbilt University report in a paper in this week's Science, there is more than one way people detect errors. And they are hierarchical. In other words, with the skilled typists Logan and Crump tested, the participants' fingers, in a way, knew when they had made an error. They slowed down. And if participants saw the wrong word typed, they took responsibility for the error even when their fingers had hit the right keys and had not slowed down. Here's Matt Crump.
People have been trying to figure out how it is that people detect errors in their performance for a long time. And typing is a good place to start looking because people make a lot of mistakes. And what we find out is that even when people aren't aware that they made a mistake, the fingers seem to be aware that a mistake occurred. This is interesting because it seems that there's a lot of control going on in a typing system. We knew that was going on at higher levels in the sense of people think about what words they want to type when they're writing an email. But it also appears to be going on in that sort of autopilot level that, you know, when you become a skilled typist, you can sort of move your fingers around without even thinking about what you're doing. But it seems that the fingers, the process is controlling the fingers, even though they don't necessarily require a lot of thought. There are still processes that are monitoring what the fingers are doing.
And so the important result of the research,
Gordon,
is to be able to separate these two different levels of control. Normally they work together hand in hand, and you know, your intentions say, I want to type these things, and your fingers go ahead and type them. But we have to find some wedge that we can push between them to separate them to get them to behave differently. And the important result of the research was to introduce these mismatches between the errors that the autopilot would see and the errors that the pilot would see. So the autopilot is looking at the fingers to make sure the fingers are in the right keys and they're moving in the right order. But the pilot is looking at the screen and seeing that the screen looks the way it ought to. Because ultimately the goal of typing is to produce something on a screen that fulfills the intentions of the person who's doing the writing.
So there are models of hierarchical control, but not of hierarchical error? Gordon?
There are models of hierarchical errors, but so there's controversy over them on the one hand, so that it's possible to model many situations that produce errors with models that aren't hierarchical, that are essentially reflex-like. And these models will account for behavior just as well as models that assume a hierarchy. So what we wanted to do is to look at a skill like typing where it is pretty clearly hierarchical and try to distinguish these levels of control in a situation where we thought it was feasible to do it, where there wasn't ambiguity about there being higher levels and lower levels of control.
How had previous researchers tested people's ability to detect errors? Matt?
I guess in the context of what we've been doing, one of the common ways is a simpler task than typing called choice reaction time task. People sit in front of a computer, they see, you know, say an X or an O, and they have to respond to whether it's an X or an O as quickly as they can. And so you can measure the speed it takes people to make correct judgments. And every once in a while, even in easy tasks like that, people make mistakes. And a common finding that we've known about for a long time is that when you make a mistake on a given trial, you usually slow down on the next trial. Sort of fits with this intuition that you can do things fairly accurately in a comfortable range of speeds, but when you speed up too fast, then you start making errors. And a lot of the perspectives on error detection sort of fall out of this simple situation where you're basically just doing one thing. And so you intend to press the X button because you see an X, and then you either do or you don't. And I mean, what we're really doing here is just taking a simple step beyond these simple tasks. Instead of having people type one thing on a screen, you know, we just scale it up and have people type a whole bunch of things on the screen like a normal typist would do. And this really just opens up the door for looking at how sort of voluntary error detection might occur and how involuntary error detection might occur and how these two things might work together.
So slowing down between keystrokes indicates that the typist, at least on some level, is aware of an error?
Sure, yeah.
So in testing skilled typists, more exactly, what did you have them do? Gordon?
We presented just single words on the screen, and we had them type the single words, and we just recorded each keystroke. But what we did on 6% of the trials is insert an error that they didn't make. So we just put something wrong on the screen. We deleted a letter, we added a letter, or we transposed letters. And we wanted to see if they would notice that. And then on other trials, we put the right thing on the screen when they made an error. And we wanted to see whether they would interpret the correct result on the screen as something that they had produced with their own fingers. So their fingers made a mistake, but the screen looked right. And in the first case, their fingers were right, but the screen looked wrong. So that allowed us to separate the pilot and the autopilot and their ability to detect errors.
So what would demonstrate that these two error detection processes were going on?
Well, we see the autopilot's error detection in the slowing that follows an error. So when you normally make an error, you're slow by really 100 or 200 milliseconds on the keystroke that follows it than you would be had you typed correctly. What we find is that the fingers respond to what the fingers are doing. So if you actually make an error, whether it's corrected or not, you slow down after it. If we insert an error on the screen, you don't slow down. So the fingers, the error detection in the fingers seems to depend on what the fingers are doing. Then to contrast with that, we had people report whether an error occurred on that trial. And people's reports seem to depend on what the screen looked like. So if the screen looked right, they said it was correct, whether or not their fingers had made an error. And if the screen looked wrong, they tended to say it was an error, whether or not they had typed it correctly. So we were able to dissociate the pilot and the autopilot, showing that the pilot judges what's on the screen and decides typing is good if the screen looks right, whereas the autopilot judges what's happening on the fingers and the keyboard and decides there's an error if something is wrong with the finger placement on the keys.
Matt, were the participants aware that the computer was sometimes inserting these errors or were correcting their mistakes?
This is one of the interesting things for me. They were aware and they weren't aware. We ran a bunch of different experiments, and in the first set of experiments, we didn't tell people about this at all. And what happened was at the end of the experiment, we started asking them questions. And they would make all these comments implying that they took ownership of all the errors that happened in the experiment. And so in the later experiments, we told people that the computer was going to be inserting errors or correcting errors on every trial. And instead of asking questions at the end of the experiment, we gave people this question after every single trial. So you'd sit down, you'd write a word, the word would disappear, and then you'd be asked to say, who did it? Did you type it correctly? Did you make an error? Did the computer make an error? Did the computer type it correctly? And even when you're making a judgment about what you just did literally half a second ago, this illusion still persists. So it suggests that even when you're aware and you're looking for the role of the computer in sort of fooling you, you still can't tell, even when you're looking for it.
And so you say you found this evidence for these two error detection processes, even when the participants knew that the computer wasn't always going to show them what they typed.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was a surprise.
Gordon?
We were thinking that if we told them, they'd be sensitive to it and they'd notice. But, you know, when we ran ourselves through the program, you don't always know. The program even fooled us. So when the screen looks right, you think that you did it.
Gordon Logan and Matt Crump, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gordon Logan and Matt Crump of Vanderbilt University are co-authors of a paper in this week's Science on how cognitive illusions of authorship reveal hierarchical error detection in skilled typists. Finally today, David Graham, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about robotic hands that don't have any fingers. How do they grab onto things, Dave?
That's a good question, Rob. And the trick is that instead of fingers, these hands have these rubber sacks that are filled with coffee grains or sometimes small glass spheres. Almost think of it almost like a little beanbag sack at the end of these robotic appendages.
I've never been able to pick up anything with a beanbag, Dave.
Well, it's not just a beanbag. What it is it's a beanbag, and there's a small pipe that sucks air from the beanbag. And you can see a picture of this and actually a video of what this looks like on the site and how it works. But basically, what will happen is the robot will move its hand over a pencil. This sack will lay down on the pencil, and then this tube that's running into the sack will actually suck air out of the sack, and that causes the sack to mold its shape around whatever object that is, whether it's a pencil or in some cases there were 1 gallon jugs of water, whatever it is, this sack molds to the shape, and then when the robot picks its arm up, the object gets picked up as well.
What prompted researchers to develop this type of new hand?
Well, Rob, a lot of engineers, when they design robots, they actually make them look a lot like people. They have legs and arms and fingers just like we do. But the problem with robotic fingers is they tend not to work nearly as well as our fingers do. They tend to be very clumsy. They slip when they try to pick up objects, or they grasp objects too hard and break them. In this new study, the researchers showed that this sack hand could actually pick up an egg and not break it. And they're also very difficult to manipulate. If you imagine you've got a computer that not only needs to control the movement of the arms, but the movement of 10 digits at the same time, and you're talking about very complex equations. So these researchers were really looking for a simpler way to make hands, even if they don't look like our hands.
Any limitations to what this hand can pick up?
Well, they have some limitations. First of all, there's a weight limitation. If the object's too heavy, the hand can't pick it up. Also, the hands had some problems with porous objects like cotton balls. And that's because, you know, when these hands grasp these objects, the tube is sucking out air. And if you've got something porous like a cotton ball, that allows air to travel through it, and therefore the hand can't mold around the object just as well as it could.
Any likelihood that this could be something that might help amputees?
Well, Rob, that's one of the cool applications of this technology is you can imagine with a artificial hand like this, you could do things that you might not be able to do very easily with robotic fingers, like swipe a credit card or even pick up a fork. Could be a lot easier with these hands. The only downside being that for somebody maybe interested in their appearance, these don't look as much like human hands.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have we brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from a new technology to help create artificial hands to a new technology that could alleviate one of the most annoying things about air travel, having to take your shoes off your feet. Rob, this story is all about an explosive known as triacetone triperoxide, or TATP for short. And this is an explosive that gained notoriety in 2001 when Richard Reed, also known as the shoe bomber, tried to detonate one of his shoes that was filled with TATP on a flight from Paris to Miami. And that's the reason Most of us have to take our shoes off in the airport these days because airport security is trying to detect the presence of this and other explosives in footwear.
So what's the new technology? A new detector for this substance?
Exactly. The idea is we have to take our shoes off because this chemical is not very easy to detect. There's some other explosives that are a lot easier to detect. They glow in ultraviolet light, or they have some other obvious characteristics that are easy to detect, but not so with TATP. But it does give off a little bit of a vapor, and that's what the scientists seized on in this study. They said, if we can develop an easy way to detect this vapor in really minuscule quantities, we could potentially develop a portable device that you could just wave past somebody's shoes, and if the device said the shoes were okay, the person could proceed through the security line and not have to take his or her shoes off.
So how does this technology work?
Well, Rob, the key is an acid catalyst known as Amberlist 15. And basically what happens is when a vapor wafts off TATP, it reacts with this catalyst. And the Amberlist 15 breaks the TATP down into acetone and peroxide. And these are both chemicals which can alter the colors of what's called a colorimetric array. And you can see a picture of this on the website. Basically, what this is a series of dots of various colors. And what would happen is you would waft a sample over these, and the colors would change if there was TATP present. Now, that's not very feasible for a security line, but there's already a company that's taking this finding and running with it. And basically, they're trying to develop a portable device that would do much the same thing, but in a much more compact way that would be easy to use for airport security personnel.
Beyond alleviating our inconvenience and having to take our shoes off in order to fly, are there any other uses for this technology?
Well, Rob, researchers have used similar technologies for less critical purposes. In fact, there was a similar device developed to differentiate between different brands of coffee. So this could be something that would be important for the manufacturing industry, the food and drug industry. A lot of places could benefit from this. It'd just be a very easy way to tell a lot about a product or a chemical without having to do a lot of very complicated tests.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from exploding shoes to an explosion of oxygen in early Earth, this last story is about how complex life may have gotten its start about 500 million years ago.
What happened then?
Well, Rob, before this time, the Earth was a very uninhabitable place. At least for you and me, it would be very uninhabitable. The main problem was that there was very little oxygen in the air. So you can imagine that any life forms, and especially the complex life we think about today that relies on oxygen, wouldn't have been around then. But all of a sudden, around 500 million years ago, you've got this explosion of oxygen in the atmosphere. You've got complex life starting to develop, and eventually you have the kind of life we see today. Now scientists think they have an answer to what triggered this explosion of oxygen in the atmosphere. And there's been a lot of hypotheses, but what makes this one different is it's actually a very ironic hypothesis. It has to do with something called snowball Earth. And this is a condition, this has happened a few times in Earth's history, where the entire planet is basically encased in ice, or almost the entire planet. The oceans are frozen over, there's ice over most of the land masses, and you pretty much have a planet that, for all intents and purposes, looks a bit like a snowball. Now, you would imagine conditions like this would be very counterproductive for life. But what researchers say in this study is that these conditions may have actually helped trigger a very important event that seeded the skies with oxygen.
And that was?
Well, Rob, what they think happened is that when you have all these glaciers forming, just like when glaciers form today, they rub up against rocks and they kind of shred these rocks up. And when these glaciers retreat, they release phosphorus from these rocks, from these ground up rocks. And in the researchers' scenario, what happens with this phosphorus is it washes into the ocean. And this is a very important nutrient for algae, and algae are photosynthesizers. They take energy from the sun, they breathe in carbon dioxide, and they breathe out oxygen. So all of a sudden, you're giving tons of food to these algae. And the researchers speculate there was a couple snowball Earth events that happened right before this 500 million year ago explosion in oxygen into the atmosphere. And so what the researchers think happened is after these snowball Earth episodes, a bunch of phosphorus got dumped into the ocean that caused these algae to basically start eating and breeding out of control, and they emitted a lot of waste product into the atmosphere, waste for them, which was oxygen.
So is there evidence that there were these multiple snowball Earths that happened one after the other like this?
Well, Rob, that's one criticism of the study. According to one view, there was only one snowball ice retreat, and that was at the end of a 10 million year long glaciation. And that may sound like a long time, but it's actually a very brief amount of time. And this expert says that was too brief a pulse, he says, to seed the oceans with the amount of phosphorus that would be required for a long-term expulsion of oxygen into the atmosphere. But other experts say that this is actually a really promising scenario, and it could actually be true. Still needs a lot of testing to figure it out, but in the meantime, it remains a very intriguing and ironic hypothesis.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, just in time for the Halloween holiday here in the U.S. and in some other countries around the world, we have the gruesome tale of the headless dragonfly. And this is a dragonfly that was trapped in amber for over 100 million years. We've also got a story about new insights into human origins. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about suicides in the U.S. military, and also a story about a mysterious anonymous online group that's accusing various stem cell researchers of scientific fraud. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the October 29th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. Thanks to Sophia Kai for her help with this week's show. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.